Welcome to part two of episode 300. Now, Fred Armisen is someone that first came on the show way back on episode 45. I went to the set of Portlandia, and we hung out, and he very graciously gave up his lunchtime to sit there with me and have a conversation. I was very much enjoying the legal cannabis in Portland that day and was overwhelmed by being on set, and I never really felt like I had the conversation that I wanted to have with Fred about punk music. And Fred's someone that has been very supportive of the show over the years and someone that I have a fairly robust text conversation with about punk rock minutia that comes up on the show. So here it is on episode 300, a chance to make things right. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the returning Fred Armisen on Turned Out a Punk. Fred, thank you so much for coming back on the show.
My pleasure. Hi.
Well, I apologize for that first episode. You're one of the first batch of people I interviewed, and listening back to it, I had it was a ball of energy back then. So thank you for be willing to come back for another stab at this thing.
Anything for you.
Well, I appreciate that. And I guess like one of the things that really jumped out at me while listening to that episode and kind of since I did that episode with you is actually like your involvement in New York hardcore. Like I had no idea going into that about KGB. Since then I've acquired the 7-inch and I'm a little more immersed in that and things like that. But I just wanted to kind of get, what was your first exposure to that particular kind of sound of stuff, New York hardcore?
I had a friend named Kenny mm-hmm. Young, mm-hmm. who I was in the KGB with, and it was completely him. Who, because he used to go into the city more, we lived on Long Island, he would get records and bring them back to Long Island. And he was just more of a curious, like New York City traveler. Like he would go to Manhattan all the time. I would go once in a while with him, mm-hmm. but he really like, and this is more symbolic too, is like I would take the Long Island Railroad in, and he always just took a bus and a couple subways. Like, that's just the way he was. He did graffiti. So he really, really knew that world. And he knew he knew about all the matinees, you know, at CBGB's, but he also knew a bunch of other shows that I wasn't as familiar with. What was some of the names? Was it A1 or 1A?
A7, yeah.
A7. So he was like always going there to see shows. So he really, really knew it and like shopped around and stuff. So the thing, he would get Maximum Rock and Roll, and then he'd just show me all the bands and stuff. But all of the compilations that we think are so like, I don't know, quaint now, at the time, they were like revolutionary. Mm-hmm. So I think Flex Your Head might've been one of them, but Let Them Eat Jelly Beans. Like now, you know, I don't know. It's like, he just really, really got into it. And as far as the actual bands go, I feel like Murphy's Law was like the biggest one that we knew. There were some bands on Long Island, like the Nihilistics, who we just never got a chance to see. Or maybe he saw them, but I never got a chance to see them.
They also claim to have beat up the Beastie Boys, right? Like, I think it's in the New York... No, it's in, like, the History of New York Hardcore book that came out a couple of years ago. They tell a story about the Beastie Boys being dropped off by their parents at a show and them beating them up. But that's their claim.
Who? What band?
The Nihilistics.
Yeah. I never got to see them, and unfortunately, but Murphy's Law, obviously, and I think Kenny was really into Agnostic Front, who I got into later, but like not, I just didn't know as many bands as he did. So my experience is that I loved being like adjacent to it, but I wasn't as familiar as Kenny was, or as I like to think I was, you know. He just went to so many shows.
It's the scene that like also that it seems like KGB was a part of is a scene that I was completely unaware of, that you know, through a bunch of reissues in the last few years, has become kind of, you know, more of a spotlight has been put on it. And that's almost like this New York hardcore thing that was really informed by Discharge. And I guess like a lot of the UK kind of crossover stuff that was happening, and, you know, specifically bands like Sacrilege and Hellbent. And ultimately KGB kind of sounds like that too. And Vic Venom, who played in Sacrilege, also played in KGB, right?
Oh yeah. And then Vic Venom went on to play with like Nausea and a bunch of other bands. And he was also like, if you know, if Kenny was the real deal, I feel like Vic Venom was even more the real deal. Like he relived it. And when I remember he left New York and he just went on tour. Like he just left to just go be, you know, part of like whatever hardcore scene was happening, like all around the country. But as far as like British bands, I remember Kenny loved, sorry they keep mentioning it, but that was my go-to for like who is who. But Discharge he loved. And then we opened for GBH. And GBH was like, weirdly, like the sort of like, for us, they seemed like the, like an ideal way to have a band. Like that was just what we looked up to as a type of band to be. Like all their graphics and stuff, and like Anti-Nowhere League were practically a pop band to us because they were so their music was so accessible.
Yeah,
you know, like it was not. It was just so accessible and so in the way listener friendly that I really loved Anti-Nowhere League a lot.
Oh yeah, definitely. And these bands were like chart bands in the UK.
Yeah, by then I feel like it was so accepted, but to us on Long Island, it was all so new. Mm-hmm. And also like, we still kind of lumped it all together, like Discharge and GBH and whoever, like we still were also still discovering The Clash and Bow Wow Wow. It, for us, we didn't separate that stuff as much. Or for me, I didn't separate that stuff as much.
Yeah. And like, you know, I think that another thing that's really, you know, I've really learned from doing this show is how interconnected it all was in the very beginning, and how you had, you know, members of the Smiths, members of the Cult, and members of Slaughter and the Dogs all hanging out together. Like that was just, you know, the scene at one point before, as you're saying, before it got codified and kind of broken into, oh, it's this thing over this thing, or it's this hybrid versus this hybrid.
Yeah. That was definitely the case. I think also like, we also weren't, I wasn't able to separate the idea of what the original punks looked like to the new ones being like GBH and all those bands. Like, you know, their hair was like a little spikier, and like there were some more like studs on people's jackets and stuff. Like there was a little bit more of a uniform, but I really followed that uniform. Like I was like, no, this is the way it's supposed to look. So I was very like, I really was into the look of it without thinking that like punk rock can look like many different things. I was like, no, punk rock is supposed to look like this.
It's funny because like you wind up in such disparate versions of punk rock, you know, over the time. And obviously this is like over a many year span, but like the scenes that you're part of with Trenchmouth, and obviously the Chicago scene must have been radically different from the Discord scene that you guys were kind of part of in DC for a moment. Like it just seems like that is so different than New York and stuff you were coming out of.
Oh yeah. And I kind of like it was a little bit more work. Like I'll call it for now the New York look. The New York hardcore look that I, how I perceived it was a little bit of work. Like there's stuff that you had to get, where I feel like in Chicago, and this is years later, it was way more industrial and pared down. I don't mean like industrial music. I mean like, you know, like Dickie's black pants, Dickie's shirt.
Yeah, utilitarian kind of vibe.
Yeah, like work Sears, work shoes, that whole look was very easy. That was really easy. And you didn't even have to define yourself. You were just sort of like, this is it. This is, you know, I don't know. There was something about it that was like just easier to try to put together.
I recently saw the Detroit History of Hardcore documentary that's coming out. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing when you think about Touch and Go, obviously, like that being such a fixture of Chicago at that time, also kind of coming out of the super gnarly young hardcore scene. Like, it's amazing how many people, you know, spawn out of these, this sort of first wave of just like gnarly hardcore bands.
Oh, you mean like a Corey's first band?
Yeah. Well, Corey's getting the Necros and like,
yeah,
just that whole Detroit kind of scene with Negative Approach and Bored Youth and The Fix, yeah, and all those bands. Like, you know, once again, it's like, I don't think quite as gnarly as it was in New York from the sounds of it, but like at the same time, it was this sort of like really scrappy hardcore scene. And yet, you know, years later, it's a sort of fixture of this sophisticated adult music in Chicago.
Yeah. I wonder how much of that like was also a matter of time. Like, even though I moved west, you know, from New York, I also feel like some of it is chronological, like somewhere punk started to become that. And also I remember hardcore sort of the tempo, the faster tempo just sort of disappearing. I heard less and less of it. Maybe that's just me, but I remember all of a sudden just tempos slowing down somewhere in there. And whenever that was, like in the 80s somewhere.
Yeah, like Lou kind of spells it out in Gimme Indie Rock, right? Where it's started smoking pot, like the music a little bit slower. Like everyone around 84, it just feels like, not necessarily always smoking pot, but the, you know, 84, 85 is kind of like this real turning, yeah, point in hardcore.
Yeah. I'm also thinking that, like, I can't remember what year Kraut was, their Adjustment to Society album. But Kraut were like weird. They were pretty big. They were like a big band, but I almost don't consider them hardcore in the same way, in that their tempos were pretty slow. Like, they had pretty straight ahead tempos that were like pretty much like fast punk rock, but not that super speed, you know?
Yeah, and they're super melodic too. I love those Kraut, yeah, records.
Kraut was really great. And I got to see them. There was also like a movement, and I've never seen it called this anywhere else, but like I started to see the sort of dreadlock punks, and it was like, we called them peace punks.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I've never heard them called that anywhere else, but it was very like Lower East Side. And, but the look and the, like what they were about, I've seen all over the place, but only in New York were they called peace punks.
Was that kind of like the squatter rot squat scene?
Yeah, like that, you know. It was almost kind of like less black and white and more colorful, like a little bit, and I liked it.
You're obviously friends with Steve Jones. I think you guys have done stuff together, right, over the years?
Yeah.
Have you ever talked to him about doing those Kraut records?
Not just that, that's the first time I ever met Steve Jones, was when he played with Kraut.
Really?
So yeah, Kraut opened for the Psychedelic Furs at Nassau Community College.
What a show.
What a show. And Paul Cook had just gotten into a car accident. So I went to the show, went to the Kraut show. I don't know how I made my way backstage. But first thing is, I think the singer was talking about he was going to college. And I was like, I don't know what I said. I must have said something like, wow, that's so cool that you're in a band, but you also want to go to college. And he said something, not in a mean way, but he was just like, yeah, what do you think? I'm a fucking idiot. So he was sort of pointing out that, like, you know, I'm a smart person. And I really liked that. I liked that as a lesson. I'm like, yeah, well, of course, that makes total sense. But then I saw Steve, and he had some sort of like scotch tape hanging down from his hair or something, like, and he was a little drunk. And I told him, I was like, I'm really sorry about Paul. And he was like, yeah, I was fucking some bird. And I thought that Steve was just making a joke and just trying to be like a classic punk. But when I've talked to Steve later about it, he was like, no, that was a true story. I was actually with a woman when Paul had his accident. So he was telling the truth. Yeah.
That's wild. It's also wild that you know, all these years later, you're still like running into this guy in completely different parts of your life, like completely different, you know.
Oh, yeah. And that, like, it was a big deal for me to meet him back then. And it's a big deal for me that I'm his friend now. Mm-hmm. And I've tried to, like, tell him that without freaking him out too much, you know. But I've said stuff like, you know, you were a poster on my wall. I had the Sex Pistols poster on my wall. But, you know, he's just like, I gotta tell you, I almost want to write about this. Like, he is a magnificent, fascinating person, Steve Jones. He's just like this really, like, he's very, like, sensitive, and he's like still, like, you know, continuing to, like, be a good person. Like, he's got all these years of sobriety, but also, like, he's just like, there's something about him that's just like heroic. And he's this California, you know, he lives in California and is not interested in going to England. He's got the thickest accent I've ever heard, not interested in going back to England. Like, he's comfortable here. This is where he wants to be. I really, really love that guy. He's really a special, special person, and funny, and like just the way he talks. I just want to hear him talking all the time.
Yeah. And I think he's super underrated too, as in terms of being a guitar player, like the stuff he did, obviously, you know, and never mind the Bollocks, but also those professional records are fucking awesome.
Yeah. He really, like, that tone, that guitar tone is not to be taken for granted. Like, mm-hmm. I think people think it's just like a distortion box, or there's a tone he gets from the guitar that is so full, and it's not just distortion. It's a full, you hear the whole guitar. It's so, so good.
Yeah. No, there's like, you know, I've always felt like the Clash are obviously an incredible band, but like the Clash would be the Clash in the 70s or in the 60s, you know, like you could play the Clash on classic rock radio, but the Sex Pistols are something that still doesn't feel comfortable on classic rock radio. Like, it still feels electric.
Yeah. And I think he played bass on a lot of those songs, he was telling me.
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
On Bollocks. But can you believe how also young he was? Like, he was like so young. I was always very like jealous about that, about bands in general from England, like how like they all started so young.
Yeah, I actually was, as I was watching that Detroit documentary the other day, thinking like, is it weird that I'm obsessed with the culture and lives of teenagers from the 80s? Like here I am, an adult with my own children, and I'm looking at videos of like 15-year-old kids playing hardcore music and just like loving it. You know, there's something
I go through the same thing. Also, that they're from so far away. Like, I'll see pictures of mods in wherever, you know, in Brighton, and I'm just like looking through these pictures, fascinated. Like, what were their lives? But they're so far away. Why am I? You know, why is it of interest?
Yeah, I don't know. It's something about, I think the margins are always the most interesting, right? And I think I'm stealing that as a quote from a book, actually, I think. But I think like the stuff in the margins is always the most interesting. The people that are drawn to subculture, especially at a time when you had to search it out, you know, like now it's different, obviously. But like back then, like, how would you become a mod? Like, was it gifted to you by an older relative, or was it a kid at
school? You know what I'll call it the sort of like Pony Express were for New Yorkers anyway, was shops, like little stores, where more than magazines, I think, where you'd see a pin and the pin kind of informed what something was. So if I went to like Bleak or Bob's or something, it was like a pin of the two-tone guy that I'd be like, okay, that's what ska looks like. And then another pin of like the Selector, you know, logo. Oh, okay, this is what ska is. It's the stuff in the glass of all the pins and like posters and stuff, where you start kind of figuring out what things mean.
Mm-hmm. And for it was me. No, I totally agree. And it's amazing how back then, how important it was that the sign and the signifier were like very much tied together. You know, you see people, you know, like, you know, famous people, athletes wearing band t-shirts, and it has nothing necessarily to do with the music of the band, but that back then it had to, because it was so important to know what you were getting by the packaging.
Oh, totally. And also there's a money thing with that too, where like, I don't remember having the luxury of just wearing whatever t-shirt. I was like, okay,
yeah,
this is $7 and it better be a band that I love. And it better be like the design that I love, or however much it was, $10 or something. But like, these shirts weren't like floating around enough to just throw whatever on. It just wasn't around. Like, it's funny. You had to buy it.
It's funny. I had a conversation the other day with a friend of mine, and we're talking about how as time goes on and things get more codified, it almost becomes like sects of Christianity, where, you know, you're like a touch and go person versus a Discord person versus an alternative tentacles person versus a lookout person. And, you know, and like, there's all these types of records that are a specific type of punk, and you wear the specific type of shirts. And yeah, it was like these little sects within punk rock that you were a devotee to.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I always, like, looking back, I'll always feel, you know, like I missed out on the whole LA scene. I just missed it. I just missed out on, I wasn't there. So a lot of scenes like that, that had a look that I just, you know, it was too far away.
And the money too, like you're saying, like it was an investment to like pick up a different style, pick up different records.
Yeah. I remember, yeah, it's just like you had to budget out, okay, what am I going to buy? What can I buy? What should I buy? So I didn't even have the luxury of sort of buying something just for the hell of it. You know, like, oh, I guess I'll pick one of these up too. It was very measured.
Yeah. No, it had to be. It definitely had to be. How did you kind of like, you know, like what was the band that kind of bridged you to more sort of the stuff that you'd be doing in Trenchmouth, like to stuff that was more kind of on the post-punk leaning sound of stuff? Like, you, I guess you'd always been in Gang of Four and bands like that.
Yeah, but anything with Timbali. So like Pigbag and like Bow Wow Wow were the sort of like that drumming. There was even a song by XTC called Living Through Another Cuba. God, although was I in touch with that song back then? But that beat, Living Through Another Cuba, is like where that's somewhere in there is where all of that lived. Mm-hmm. So somewhere in there, it was like somewhere with all those bands, that's kind of where I was headed. And then with Trenchmouth, let me think. By then, I think Firehose's drumming, the Minutemen drumming, you know, George Hurley was kind of like in there. I can't remember what else, but somewhere in there was like, this is kind of what I want this kind of drumming to sound like. That's where the bridges were.
And like you're saying, there's a transition point also kind of happening in punk in general. Like, this is the emergence of post-hardcore, right? Like the stuff that was coming after that first wave.
Yeah, like Big Boys. Damon mm-hmm. from Trenchmouth was like sort of introducing me to them. So all of that kind of stuff. And then later, of course, like Fugazi, which, you know, I know that they changed how many bands played, but, you know, clearly that was like a turning point for a lot of bands and for us, you know.
Were you in DC when that happened with Fugazi, when Fugazi started playing out?
New York. So Damon took me to go see them. So I went to School of Visual Arts with Damon, mm-hmm. The singer of Trenchmouth. That's where I met him. So this is 80. It's not quite 88. Maybe it's 87, 88. But he took me to go see them in Hoboken at Maxwell's.
What were the bands that were kind of like, I guess, you know, were you into kind of in between like the end of KGB and kind of the start of Trenchmouth? Like, were there stuff happening in New York?
Meat Puppets. I would say Meat Puppets were huge to me. Husker Du was huge to me. Mm-hmm. Those were definitely the bigger ones. Firehose, I just missed, you know, I missed the like when Minutemen were like touring. I missed it. I just for me, it was, it just like, I had to go backwards to the Minutemen. But Husker Du, Bad Brains, of course.
Were you kind of aware of all that, like, you know, the Swans and I guess like the Pussy Galore and early Sonic Youth, like the stuff that I guess would be labeled the time pig fuck music for some horrible reason?
Swans, yes. But for some reason, those other bands, no.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. So any like no wave stuff, I just didn't know.
It's really interesting about New York is that it is, you know, like, I guess because it's so big and there's so many people there that every scene does seem a lot more factioned off, you know, than other places. Like, you know, these scenes don't seem to intermingle in the same way that they do in say a city like Detroit, you know, where there's just less people.
Yeah. And for me, like the added thing, which is like, it's almost not something I can't really, well, I'm too old to be like not proud of this kind of thing, but I'm also like a Long Island guy. So
yeah,
like
yeah.
For a long time, I'm like, I'm a New York guy. What? Then I'm like, wait a minute. I'm a suburban guy. Like I went to the city, you know, I lived there a little bit, but I kind of went back to Long Island. So like my record collection kind of, I think, reflected that. I think with Fishbone and stuff like that, I'm just, we were like, there's something also a little like sort of pretty about the music that I listened to back then.
Well, like, were you into like Galaxy 500 and were they starting to go before you left
them.
New York?
No, I missed them completely.
Well, it's amazing how like, yeah, like you're, well, I guess like it's like being a hardcore kid and then, you know, the Trenchmouth stuff seems like very much part of that Discord. I guess Skeen is kind of a separate thing, but like.
Yeah, no, we were heavily influenced. We were like very heavily informed by Discord. And then to the credit of the other band members, God, it is such a cliche thing to say, but they really were into dub. They really were into like King Tubby and Lee Scratch Perry. And it was all brand new to me, but they really, yeah, they really were into it. They were into all that stuff and Barry Adamson and all kinds of stuff, you know? So luckily they just introduced me to all of that.
It was also an amazing time for that stuff getting reissued on CD and a lot of that stuff that was like, you know, previously kind of inaccessible or only accessible if you like really dug for it. Like we're kind of coming back around for the first time in the early 90s.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. You just like, you're going into a part of my brain that I'm really glad that I haven't like sorted this out on paper beforehand, but I really am searching through my brain going like, oh yeah, that's right, early 90s. I think as time goes, I mix it all up together.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm making sure not to say anything that I have any assumptions about, you know what I mean?
So yeah,
like I'm like, yeah, I really loved Big Boys, but let me make sure that it is accurate to when I really, you know, the first time I heard them, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But they really meant a lot to me. And Meat Puppets, I kind of can't stress enough how much they meant to me as well, as a sort of opening of like, punk rock does not have to sound like you think it has to sound.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause they, to me, are very much like I actually consider them part of the hardcore scene. And I'm like, hardcore can be the Meat Puppets.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Like that's the best thing about that SST scene. When you look at those, that first wave of bands where you got like them, the Minutemen, the Descendants, ultimately Husker Du and Saccharine Trust and Black Flag. And they're all like doing this thing, but it's like a completely different take on it. And just so out there, like all those bands still sound really fucking out there today.
They really do. And thank God for that. And they must have been in some remote towns because it's just so odd sounding still, the choices that they made.
I'm kind of obsessed with the Arizona and like the stuff that came
out. I know. Why?
It's so weird.
Like, why there? I mean, I guess it makes sense that they're so isolated, but like, what a scene. What an incredible, like, they really, it had a very alien view of it all.
Yeah. Yeah. Like it really, you know, like there's just like, yeah, like a real dark take on punk rock, yeah, like all that Placebo record stuff.
Yeah. Really interesting.
Yeah, Colorado's like that too. Like the Colorado, the Denver scene. And I interviewed someone from there, and he was talking about how that's like a capital for cults. There's like a lot of like religious cults out there and a lot of like doomsday kind of cults out there. And then like there's these bands out there, like there's this band Your Funeral, kind of a goth band, and the lead singer winds up doing movies with Joe Coleman and becomes like a dealer of serial killer artifacts and art. Like she becomes the agent for John Wayne Gacy as a painter.
No, this I do not know about.
I will send you the news clipping about this woman, but it is fascinating. Like, and it's like that's not the only band from Colorado that has some weird ass story attached to it. It feels like.
Wow, Colorado. I feel like I don't know enough about the Colorado scene, except for like Jello Biafra, I guess, was originally from there or something. Yep. But
yeah. And do you remember The Fluid?
Oh yeah.
they were from there. They were called Bumcon originally, and they were like I think they were Bumcon, or no, the Frantics. My Dad's a Fucking Alcoholic was their song. But yeah,
were they like The Fluid? I remember a bunch of my friends liking. I can't remember exactly, but weren't they like a little slower, or mm-hmm. am I wrong?
Yeah, no, they definitely were. Like they sound kind of more grunge than any of the Seattle bands. Like,
okay, that is my first that's the first time I heard about music that was like that, was The Fluid. That was the one that everyone was like, this is like slower and more intense or something.
Yeah, they kind of happened, I think, just before all the Sub Pop stuff started really exploding. Like, obviously, they end up being on Sub Pop, but their first record kind of just before that wave, and seems to have kind of like gotten a lot of buzz around that time, you know, just, yeah, you know, and it almost feels like the Seattle stuff came out and kind of stole all that thunder.
Yeah, that seems to always happen, that there's like that first catalyst. Hey, I got a question for you.
Yeah.
Because now you've got my brain going. There's a band we really got into in Trench Mouth, but they were a DC band, but not a Discord band. Okay. They were called, and this is, they were before us, but we really got into them. They were called 9353.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And yeah, they were really, really great. And I think they ended up on a label, like a DC label called Adult Swim later, like in the 90s, but like just a fantastic band.
There's like this whole kind of DC scene that I don't really know that much about, but apparently it was like kind of a heavier drug scene. And it crosses over with bands like The Obsessed, and like I had Bubba Dupree from Void on the podcast not too long ago, and he talked about how there was like, after Void, he was doing this band with the guy from The Obsessed, and they would play with 9353. And it's like, it feels like there was like this sort of like, you know, kind of darker and kind of like after the first wave of DC stuff, but like darker, yeah, DC scene.
That sounds right, because they weren't quite in that scene, but they're still from there.
Yeah.
God, I love them. They were really, really fantastic.
You know what's wild? Like, you know who is a DC band is Royal Trucks.
No.
Yeah, they actually met in DC because Pussy Galore started in DC, and they have like, even on their first seven, it says "Fuck Ian" on the back or something.
So why am I thinking of them as New York?
Because they all moved to New York eventually. They're all like, "Fuck this," and pulled up stakes.
Wow.
And made the no opposite idea. Move.
No idea.
It's funny because when she was on the show, she was talking like, yeah, like I used to go to, you know, I would go to Minor Threat shows. Like that was my shit. And she said that actually Royal Trucks, the reason they had all that feedback and all that noise is because she wanted to make it like Discharge, where you had to struggle to hear the song through all the noise up front.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it makes that band even cooler. Like they're the coolest, yeah, band ever.
Yeah, I had no idea. I think Trench Mouth might have played a show with them.
Oh, that'd be a weird show.
Yeah, it was somewhere I think it was part of like something where there was like a bunch of bands playing. So it's not like we were anywhere close to playing with them, but I think there was, we had some kind of crossing of paths at some show in the Midwest. I can't remember where.
You know, we talked about this last time, how like Trenchmouth was definitely ahead of its time. And I think we even talked about At the Drive-In. And now I think I said, if you guys have been around at the same time as At the Drive-In. And then it's funny, cause like Cedric from At the Drive-In was on the show and talked about what an influence seeing you guys was on him and Omar when you guys played San Antonio at some point.
Yeah. Damon told me that they said that, and that makes me very happy. What a nice thing. That's so cool.
Well, it's awesome because like it definitely, you know, it felt like, you know, and I'm looking from a distance, obviously geographically and historically, but it feels like Trenchmouth never really got its due while you guys were around. And there's almost like through influence, it's like vindication on some level, I would hope.
Oh yeah. That always brings me happiness, you know, to think that like anyone was influenced in any way. That's always really, really nice. And then like, you know, like I have a way of like painting the picture of what it was like to be in Trenchmouth. And it's very convenient to say like, oh, we didn't get our due and we, you know, played so many empty places. But like, I have to remind myself that like we played some also crowded places and some, we did well in a lot of cities. So I have to remind myself not to beat myself up too much about how we did, because there were some shows that were, you know, huge and really, you know, for us, a phenomenal.
Yeah, it's weird when you think, you know, Keith Morris was on the show a couple of weeks back and was talking about how, like, I was talking about that legendary Circle Jerks tour and how crazy that tour was. Like, all, every show must have been wild and the birth of every scene. He's like, yeah, most shows were like 30 people. Yeah. I'm like, oh really? He's like, yeah, no one cared. And it was oh shit, like I guess, you know, it's hard to have, you know, and why should you, but like have historical perspective when you're in the middle of that. But like, you know, even like thinking about the Lesser Free Trade Hall show in Manchester, there's 30 people at that show and it's like the most legendary show of all time.
Yeah. And even show that like I consider to be so huge, are still in pretty small venue. I'm not saying for Trenchmouth, I'm saying for bands who I've seen, same thing. I'm like, I doubt that they were sold out, or I know it wasn't a big venue. It was just, to me, it was spectacular, you know?
Yeah, no, I find when you go back to a venue and you look at it years later, you're like, oh wow, this is way smaller than I remember.
Yeah, exactly.
But I guess that's because you're a kid and you physically grow up. And so that everything does feel a little bit smaller at that point.
Yeah, totally different.
Do you ever miss like doing like a touring band, or is it something where you like, because obviously, you know, as you say, you make a point of it not being the most pleasant experience.
There are things about it that I miss. Drumming from city to city is really great. Mm-hmm. You know, playing the drums in Atlanta and then, you know, North Carolina somewhere, that's, I love that. I love walking out into the audience and then seeing my drums up on some weird stage somewhere. I'm like, wow, this is a different state. And there's my drums. That stuff I miss. I miss, you know what I miss? Meeting other bands. Mm. Now I'm like, wow, whatever happened to them? They were really nice. That was a great band. And I miss that. I miss being excited about selling merch. Whoa, we made $60. This is $60 in cash. And then I miss laughing with my friends in the van.
Yeah.
So those things I miss. And then looking at a tour book, like, oh, here's our tour. Whoa, this is a long one. That's exciting. So That's what I'm gonna think about right now. The things that I do miss, and those I did miss. Those.
Did you ever go out opening for other bands on tour?
No, we opened for Jonestown. We opened for Jawbox. I don't know how many shows, but I remember it was like still a string of shows. Mm-hmm. Dog-Faced Hermans. Can't remember who else. But as far as touring goes, that's who we played with.
I've definitely seen, I've even sent you some like amazing Trenchmouth flyers from Chicago popping up on that old Chicago Flyers Instagram.
Oh yeah, I love when you send those. Those are,
Well, I just love those flyers because you guys are playing with, like, you know, such amazing bands. And another thing that's kind of come up since we talked the first time is, like, that period in Chicago, like early 90s Chicago, it just feels like there's a DIY music explosion in that city where, you know, much like New York, there's like a million different types of bands going on, but it feels a little bit more connected than it was in New York.
Yeah, I think it's just because it's smaller. Like, I think because it's like fewer people, I think there's something a little more focused about it. But speaking of flyers, oh my God, that was like the focal point. That was a major part of the show. It was like, all right, we got to get to Kinko's. This one's going to be, Damon's going to do a print of four frogs and a church. No way. Look at that. Make the font bigger, you know, just like putting together, like it was such a, also putting up flyers was like a whole job.
Yeah. Oh God. Yeah.
You know, did you go uptown? Yeah. We went to this record store and this record store. Great. We got all these, we got glue and put them up on poles. I mean, it took up so much time.
Well, thank goodness you did though, because here we are all these years later and people are still, you know, looking at these flyers. Like if you just,
oh, I love together. It. I'm so glad. And they were, I will say they were cool, cool flyers. They were not lame. They were like really, Damon did them well-designed and awesome. Was very happy about those flyers.
And it's funny, like it's an also a lost art that I've got a friend who does a label in San Francisco, Scotty, or in Oakland, I should say, Scotty, Tank Crimes. And he still makes a point that you flyer for shows and it will affect your draw. And here we are in this age where everyone's like, oh, let's just make a, you know, an Instagram post or a TikTok video or something to probably promote a show at this point. But
that's all you need.
But then you don't, right? Because you still, like, there's something about a physical flyer that's out there in the world. Like, it still catches my eye when I see one on the pole. Maybe more now than it did. Oh,
I see what you mean. No, I meant, like, nowadays, as much as I hate to use that word, yes, but it's, you know, that's what the requirement is, like, to put up an Instagram post. But, like, no, I'm in total agreement. What a great art form a flyer is. I still see them once in a while, but it's, you know, so yeah, no, I'm with you. It's a great, great art form. It makes it more real or something. I don't know.
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah. It adds legitimacy to it.
Yeah.
One thing we also talked about last time, but I just got to nerd out with you about it again, is that Octung Chicago's Phi.
Oh yeah.
That comp. It's amazing when you go through that track list, just to back up my point further, that like, it's like the birth of the emo through Cap and Jazz, you know, yourselves are on it as well. It's, I mean, Los Crudos is on it. Like one of the most important hardcore bands of the 90s is on that. And did you ever play with Los Crudos?
I can't remember.
They are like,
I mean, I'm like, you know, I know who they are and I'm aware of them, but like, I feel like we did. But someone might get me on a technicality, like, actually, no, you didn't. So it's one of those things of like, here's this. My assumption is that we did.
I'm sure you probably would. Like, just it feels like that scene, all those scenes were mixed together.
There were shows that they used to do in Elgin, Illinois.
Yeah.
And that's where it would have been. This guy, Brian, would put out shows out there. And Brian Peterson. And that's where I vaguely remember playing with them, if we did.
Yeah, it's once again, like, just, I guess, a testament about, you know, when, as you say, because of the smaller population, but the fact that you have all these different styles of bands mixing together, not just on comps, but at shows, you know, like it's a testament to that, like how diverse that sound was in there. And that's not even counting like the bigger Touch and Go stuff, which was also, I'm sure, happening at the same time.
Oh, I'm looking at the comp right now. So I just grabbed it.
Oh, you have it? You still have your vinyl on it?
I have the CD.
Okay.
And so, like, and my memory was correct, is that, oh, this is Octum Chicago Zwei. This is the Zwei. Second one.
Didn't I say Zwei? Yeah.
Okay. What I remember about this cover is it doesn't look like the punk rock from before. This is what Chicago looks like to me. Like, that's what punk rock looked like in Chicago. That's the look. I'm looking at a guy playing a bass. It's got like a zipper sweatshirt on, work shoes, And then the front cover too is like, it's punk rock, but this is like a very different look. It's different than New York, mm-hmm. different than DC. It's like, this is, they picked the right pictures for it.
Yeah. And it feels like DC, you know, like not that this is, you know, by design, but like almost like Discord. It's like it's such a presence that it looms so large that the bands tend to be of a certain style at a certain point. Whereas in Chicago, it's like there's no sort of like overarching scene. So it just feels like it's all over the map and everyone's playing together.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Smoking Jesus. Popes had a hit off this, too.
Smoking
right?
Popes. Yeah, there they are. Maybe the biggest band from that scene. I don't know.
It's hard to say because, like, you know, it's like we talked about, like, the influence that these bands would have, you know, like, you know, we've talked about yourselves, but Cap and Jazz, obviously, through that emo stuff.
Yeah. I mean, they got huge.
Huge. Yeah. Los Crudos, once again, like,
yeah,
you know, Vindictives and the pop punk stuff and the Boweevils and the pop punk stuff. Like, it's a lot of, like, sort of crucial bands from the early 90s are represented on this comp.
Yeah. Did they ever like reissue this or anything?
It came out on vinyl on Two Colors. I'm trying to get every record on Underdog, which is the label that put it out, and I'm getting there. But no, they've never done like any sort of like proper sort of reissue of it. Even the Trenchmouth stuff too. I'm surprised like that's never been reissued.
And are Underdog like active?
No, I think that's the label. Yeah, it was run by Ben Weasel and Jughead from Screeching Weasel along right. with their friend at the time. So I don't think they've put
and
out
they
a
just
record.
Stopped?
Yeah, I don't think they put out a record since like 97.
But even as like a catalog label?
No, I don't think I don't think any of this is on streaming.
Wow.
Maybe the Cap and Jazz stuff because Cap and Jazz ultimately winds up on J-Tree.
Yeah. God.
Oh, and Boweevils. I think Boweevils have reissued their stuff, but like, no, there's something like I don't think the 8 Bark 7 Inch is on there. You know, and then, of course, the Screeching Weasel stuff would probably be on there too.
Man, what a label! So cool.
Yeah, like I the story of punk rock is told through the labels. I've always found, you know, there's always just like.
Yeah.
It just shows it's such a like slice of scenes.
Yeah, it's also like where you see the most like love because it's like a band, you know, they promote themselves and stuff. But when a label promotes a band, you're like, oh man, they love them.
Yeah. They really like, you know, this person made that personal investment in this financially.
They put effort into the artwork. They, you know, wrote little, you know, descriptions of the bands. They called, you know, radio stations, all that stuff.
Yeah, no, and especially then too, because it's not like there was a lot of hope of this stuff crossing over and getting popular. Like you're doing it because you love it.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, and once again, like here we are all these years still looking back on this stuff. So it did have resonance, even if it is just on one podcast.
Yeah, but it's like, to me, it's like the biggest thing. Like the fact that you're doing this podcast is like, it's so weird. I just, this will always have like the biggest space in my heart for like, oh, it's such a corny word. I'm so sorry. But it's like, it's just, you know, it to me, it's like the biggest thing. It's even because it's not just talking about classic punk rock. It's like, then it, when you want to get down to the punk rock that I actually played in and grew up with in Chicago, I'm like, man, it's a, you know, it's just such a big part of my life.
It's amazing how formative these years are. Like that's always been the thing. And like with this podcast, I've found that like when I was talking to people, like when I first met you at backstage of that show, and you know, I just went up to you and I just started talking to you about punk rock, you know, and I met Danger Aaron at that show too. And we just started talking about punk rock, you know. It's just like when you, all of us that came out of this genre or through this genre, it just is so impactful while you're in it. And it's such a short period of your life.
Yeah, it really is, although it seems like at the time it's like everything.
It's everything. Yeah. And like, yeah, years later it's still, you know, like the morals you kind of learn in it, you know, like are still things that you react to later in your life.
Oh, all the time. Even like even when I'm doing, you know, comedy stuff, that stuff always stays with me.
Mm-hmm.
Like Corey Rusk and Ian MacKay and all those people, that they're, you know, who they are, it kind of always stays with me.
Yeah.
Also like Bettina Richards from Thrill Jockey.
Mm-hmm.
Just the way that they ran those labels, you know,
mm-hmm.
and protected them and everything.
Yeah. No, it go on. Sorry.
No. You.
No, I was just going to say exactly like you're saying, like it, these people become, you know, it's amazing when you talk to, you know, like Moby, and Moby's talking about being the biggest rock star in the world and feeling guilty because he had Ian MacKay on his shoulder the whole time being like, is this the thing to do? And you're thinking about, well, Moby, the same guy that licensed every single song off that record to a commercial. But like, you know, but like, imagine that having that Ian MacKay guilt, having done that.
It would have been yeah. It. Yeah. I really identify with that. That is really, really funny. The person I hang on to the most is Steve Albini. Because Steve Albini will say, he's a little different in that, like, he loves saying that he doesn't care.
Yeah.
Which is great. Meaning in contractually.
Yeah.
Can we do this? I don't care. I don't care what you do. I don't care. And so that stays with me sometimes. I kind of like, it's even better than just saying no. It's by saying I don't care. I don't know. I just like, I do follow Steve's way of doing that. Of like, I don't need to know these kinds of details.
He is never wrong. I will.
He is never wrong.
In any of my interactions, even when he's wrong, he is never wrong.
No. God. How does he do it?
What a subculture that has given us these personalities, you know, like.
I know. And also these personalities, they were kind of like alone. Like they're not part of like some army where they have a bunch of people backing up. It must have been to develop these personalities in the face of all of, you know, the music business and everything. I think must have been a real challenge and they just did it.
I guess it would have been, you know, it's different back then because you could kind of do it in your own little world, right? Like it wasn't like now where if you tried to do it or if you did it, you're like subject to the whole world.
Yeah. True.
Like it would be.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Like, I don't know. Could there be, much like there couldn't be, could there be another Ian MacKay in the present day? Could there be another Steve Albini in the present day?
Oh man, I don't know. I don't know. It's like, thank God I don't have to like even consider. I'm like, at least I lived through the world where they could exist, but
yeah.
I don't know. I have no idea.
And perhaps we're better never knowing. I think that's the ultimate thing.
Yeah.
Did you actually have any, speaking of notorious personalities, did you ever have any run-ins or see Gigi Allen?
No, not at all. Not at all.
It's so far.
Not even close. I don't think I've ever met anyone who had been to a performance. I don't think that's, you know, I mean, I know Joe Coleman.
Oh, really? You know Joe?
Oh yeah.
I'm a huge fan. I like the Steel Tips are one of my favorite bands ever.
He's I worship Joe Coleman.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, come on. What an artist.
Yeah, absolutely. And like,
yeah.
And someone that was there at the very beginning, right? Like, have you ever seen that? There's that footage of Steel Tips. I think they tacked it on the beginning of the Dead Boys DVD that MVD put out years ago. But there's a like a pro shot performance clip of the Steel Tips playing. And Joe Coleman comes out and, of course, explodes.
With the firecrackers and stuff.
Yeah, he does the firecrackers and he kind of attacks the audience and and then the band starts playing and it's phenomenal.
I think they put that in his documentary. I've seen it in other places too, but
well, there's that old. Yeah. Do you remember the research back in the day did a documentary on him?
Yes. What was it called?
I'm trying to remember. Like it was like was it Joe? Joe Coleman's Superstar.
I think it's is that what it is?
Well, then there's, they made another one with Asia Argento in it, like later, like more recently, I mean, but there's like one from the early 90s that was like VHS, you know, order from the back of Forced Exposure magazine.
Yeah, yeah. Type thing. But it's, this is such a dumb thing to say, but it's called something, but I forget what it is.
The Passion of Joe? No, like.
It's right, yeah, yeah, something like that. Oh, God, I'm so lazy. I'm like, now I'm going to go to my shelf.
You have all that shit?
I don't know.
But damn.
I don't know. But it's not it wouldn't be VHS. Do I have a DVD of something of Joe's? As soon as I hang up with you, I'm going to find it. But I have something. I have something of his. But it's like a bootleg DVD.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, maybe that must be it then. Like that research stuff, because that's totally.
Now that you say Passion of the Joe, that actually does sound familiar.
That's what I think it might, but I'm also thinking it might be Joe Coleman Superstar. But that was also, I don't know if you remember this 90s tape trading classic, but the Charles Manson Superstar.
No, that one I don't know.
It's just like a 1 hour VHS interview with Charles Manson, where the interviewer has a lot of sympathy for Charles and just lets him go. You know, like it's not like Geraldo, where Geraldo's, you know, going in there with a bit of an agenda. Like this guy's just like, yeah, talk. So in Charles Manson, it's just like, it's like you're hearing him scatting or free form poetry or something. It's
wow.
It's really weird. I'm sure that's on YouTube, but that was called Charles Manson Superstar. So I don't think it's Joe Coleman Superstar.
I have a Gigi Allen one. Hated.
You never worked with Todd Phillips, right?
No.
Because that's the guy I would love to hear stories from making that movie.
I met with him. I think he sent me this. I had a meeting with him, but I've never worked with him.
Have you watched it?
I think I have not.
Oh my God. Fred, I am telling you, that is you got to watch it for the parts with Dee Dee Ramone alone.
Oh, Dee Dee.
It is amazing. He joins the band and doesn't really know what he's getting into. It is without a doubt the most extreme music performance video. And I believe on that DVD, it also has Gigi Allen's last concert footage, which is after he played the gas station in Manhattan, just him wandering around the Lower East Side naked, trying to hail a cab.
Oof.
It's a heavy watch.
What did he die of?
A heroin overdose. Right. In the hotel room. He didn't do it on stage, though. He never got the chance to. That was his big threat, that he was going to do it on stage one day.
Wow.
Well, this is, you know, not to bore you with all this shit, but like the gnarliest thing is after he died, they became like the apostles of Christ after Christ died, like all his fans. And just start like wandering around apparently the Lower East Side of New York, just robbing people and fucking with people. Like I've had multiple people come on the podcast that grew up in New York in like the mid 90s post Gigi Allen dying and just talk about how the murder junkies just fucked with them. And in some cases tried to ruin their lives.
I remember one time when I was talking to Jello Biafra, he was saying that was like kind of like, their goal was like to scare people. He's like, we used to scare people on the street. Like that was like, I guess it was different than the Gigi Allen army, but there was this other sort of physical thing happening.
I guess it's kind of like Tim Leary and like the idea of like showing up and having freakouts, you know, and freaking out norms.
I guess so. Yeah. That seems like what the goal was.
And it's just like such a thin line before you're all of a sudden, you know, got some family and you're Charles Manson, you know, like you're really walking a dangerous edge when you're messing with normal people, quote unquote.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had this guy also, Omar Doom, who is only in Quentin Tarantino movies. He's been in like 4 or 5 Quentin Tarantino movies, and he hung out with the Gigi Allen gang post Gigi Allen dying. And he was part of that crew.
Wow.
And now he's just in Quentin Tarantino films. That's very...
The other interesting thing is that I didn't realize how interested you were in Gigi Allen.
I think he's just like, I'm not you know, obviously there's no hero worship with this at all.
No, no, no. I wasn't saying that, but just
And I know I wanted to make sure you didn't think that I was like, but at the same time, I think there's just no other thankfully, no other performer that extreme ever. Right. Like,
yeah.
Like just willing to be. And I think the thing that also from what you hear in interviews with people that hung out with him is he kind of thought he was going to be famous, you know, and kind of thought this was going to be the ticket, you know? And at one point he kind of was like, he did that when he did that comeback, when he got out of prison, like Thurston Moore and Jay Maskus and Gerard Cosloy are all in his band.
Yeah.
He could have done it. He could, we could live in a world where he was on like 120 minutes if he had survived.
But that seems totally possible.
It does seem terrifyingly possible.
Yeah.
It would have been like a way more scary Marilyn Manson.
But it also, on the other, it could have been the kind of thing, scary Marilyn Manson, but he could have been one of those people who like, that was in his past. So they'd be like, Gigi, you used to be that guy and now you produce this show for HBO and you're, you know, you're doing your spoken word. How do you look back on the days when you were that Gigi Allen? That could have been his reality.
Guys, I'm through it. I'm through it. I don't want to talk about the shitting on the people anymore.
Yeah. I mean, Joe Coleman doesn't do those performances either, too. You know?
No, that's true. But I think, I think the thing is, Joe Coleman also was a brilliant artist, and Gigi wasn't the brilliant poet I think he thought he was.
Right, a little bit more of a show.
A little bit more of a show, yeah. A little bit. You know, like El Duce is another example of that, you know, from The Mentors.
This I don't know about.
You don't remember El Duce? He also claims that Courtney Love at one point in that Kurt and Courtney documentary with Nick Broomfield claims that he was hired to kill Kurt Cobain.
Really?
Yeah. You got to watch that documentary. It is a phenomenal movie, but his parts alone are worth the price of admission. But then he was hit by a train a couple weeks later and died. But
really?
Yeah. And their whole thing was that they were, their whole gimmick was that they were violent sexual abusers of women. And that's what they pitched the band on. Like, that was the gimmick. And they were signed to Metal Blade Records and played on.
Wow.
They made some appearances on the Jerry Springer Show real early on. They would wear black sort of Klan hoods on stage. Like, everything about this band just seems like a nightmare, but it was kind of, not crossover popular, but certainly, you know, poking at the mainstream in a way that something like this should never poke at the mainstream.
Wow.
Yeah. And to make it even weirder, this dude, El Duce, grew up in Seattle, played in this band that featured members of the Screamers, Nikki Sixx from Motley Crue, and that the guy who played drums, who passed away recently, but he played in like all the industrial bands and he played in REM. In the last few years, Bill, I can't remember his last name now. Oh, I can't believe I'm blanking on it, but he's a very famous drummer. But they all played in this glam band in the late 70s in Seattle.
Late 70s?
Yeah. Early 80s, late 70s, like the first wave of punk rock stuff.
Wow.
What an assemblage of humanity.
Totally, yeah. Like, I want to see them together again and to talk about, oh my God, what were we?
Yeah, sadly, I think Nikki Sixx might be the only surviving member of this group right now. But, you know, that's what I would want to find out. Like, forget Motley Crue stories. Those have been told. I want to find out, what was rehearsals like at that band. And apparently they came out of a high school. Mark Arm told me they came out of a high school where, like it's like the most incredible music high school ever. Sir Mix-a-Lot went there. Like, all the members of all the Seattle punk bands went there. Duff McKagan went there. Like, everyone went to this weird high school in Seattle.
Do you know the name of the high school?
He says it on the episode. I can't remember. I wish I had written it down, but.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
That is really, really cool.
That's
a truly cool high school.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it speaks to the fact that, like, once again, punk rock kind of connects so many different worlds, right? Like so many different people, you know, like,
yeah,
seeing you do that sketch, you know, we talked about it last time on SNL, though, all of a sudden it hit me like, oh man, this dude is a deep head about punk and hardcore.
Yeah. I got away with putting it on, you know, doing it on the air. I'm just so glad it made it.
I would say that's the, you know, obviously the third song of the Fear performance on Saturday Night Live, and that are the two punkest moments in the history of Saturday Night Live.
Coming from you, I really, really appreciate it.
Well, I tell you, and also you brought up on that first conversation, the B-52s and how important seeing them on SNL was for you.
Yeah.
And kind of huge. And I never really thought of them as being, you know, like, you know, obviously I love that band and I think they're hugely important, but I think I never really thought of them in that way, like as being, and that performance in particular being such an important gateway. And since you were on, so many people have come on and talked about how key that particular performance was in getting them into this thing.
Oh, really? The B-52's performance?
Yeah. Like, it's like almost like that Velvet Underground thing, that cliche that everyone says, like everyone that bought the Velvet Underground record when it came out went out and started a band. Like, but it feels like almost everyone that saw that B-52 performance went out and started a band.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm so glad other people have said that. That was just spun everything around in the way that like we could separate new wave and punk rock all you want, but like that to me was like punk rock with a capital P.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I've kept you way longer than I told you I would, Fred. Anytime you want to come back and be punished more and have your memory, you know, just taken to the ringer more, let me know.
I get so much out of this because number one, I learn about stuff that I didn't know. And then you actually make me like, I really go down the hallways of my brain of like, wait, oh, let's see what we got here. So I really, really appreciate that. And your message of punk rock, I believe in you. I believe in your message. And I want to add one more quick thing, that there's like a new Scissor Girls are part of that Chicago scene.
Uh-huh.
And they've got a record. I think they're releasing their demo. I think sometime soon. Scissor Girls.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, definitely I will. That, you know, like, and that's the thing, you always rep for bands. You always support, you know, the cool bands. So man, I'm happy you're out there waving that flag for punk rock still.
Oh, and I'm glad you are too.
And my kids are going to, like, you know, I'm talking to Cole. You know, I'm talking to Cole right now on the phone. So the kids are stoked.
That's right.
I put him in bed tonight. I'm like, I'm going to go later on. I'm going to talk to Cole on the phone.
That's and right.
My five-year-old was very excited.
Oh, he was, I'm so glad.
He was pretty fucking impressed. I talked to Deathstroke the other day, but it was much more impressive talking to Cole.
Wow. Well, thank you. I'm glad. The honor was mine.
I own a junk shop.
Where are you getting all this shit?
Mostly thrifting, but sometimes just on the street. You know, the stuff I found on the street is really cool. It's like I found like a mini display to VGA, like cord, a 20-foot HDMI cord, a copy of Super Mario Galaxy for Wii, a CBC, this bag that I used to hold my, you can't see it. It's a Radio Canada, Canadian Broadcasting Corp mobile recording kit, like rucksack, like that you would kind of have over the shoulder. And it's like really convenient and I can put my stuff in it. And and t-shirts at thrift stores and shit at garage sales. It's like, it doesn't make any sense, but you know what does life?
The wildest shit I've ever found on the street was one time walking on my mom's old street, Carlaw in Riverdale. Mm-hmm. I found outside this house, two water damaged Death in June records and the first Liquid 12 inch.
Yeah. That's wild. I mean, wild.
It just like, and I found them, and like, how nuts is it that I never knocked on the door? Like, I never went down walking past this house. Like, you know, I granted I didn't live there anymore. I was like, I already moved out. But like, I just never had a curiosity knocking on the door being like, hey, what are you into? Because this shit is fucking crazy that you have this just sitting outside your house.
Did you sell it?
No, I traded the Death in June records and I kept the liquid 12 inch. So I still have that liquid 12 inch and it's slightly water damaged on the cover, but
yeah,
holy shit. I'll never find another one.
I had all these, hip hop 12 inches and, Ultramagnetic MCs albums. And, but they were being stored at my sister's friend's place in a closet. And, I think cleaning products leaked into the, vinyl stuff. And so the labels are water damaged are like chemical damaged. And then, and some of the vinyl is, but yeah, it's quite frustrating to discover that it's the worst.
Which Ultramagnetic MCs album?
I think Critical Beatdown and also the Four Horsemen, which I was just thinking about the other day.
Is that in good condition?
It's chemical damaged. Chemical damaged.
I think
it's a vinyl.
I think the Four Horsemen is in good condition.
Now. How much are you going to sell that for?
I don't know. It's kind of complicated because actually this guy lent them to me like 20 years ago.
Oh, they're yours.
But it's a guy I know. It's someone who's like around. So I'm like, should I just give these back to Mark? Like, you know.
Mark,
like,
Jared?
No, this guy, Mark, who does this stuff, Ono Kabazian. He used to work at Grasshopper Records. He's an awesome dude. But he doesn't even live in Toronto anymore.
The records got chemical damage too. So you got to, like, when you call him back, be like, dude, do you want these records back? Caveat, they are chemical damage.
But Damien, just to let you know how amazing Cool Keith is, because I've kind of been getting back into Cool Keith. Like, he's so incredible. Like, he's such a legend. It's wild. He's one of the most, and he still works, you know? And like,
Well, you know my story, right?
I kind of remember that you had a Cool Keith story.
I went and interviewed him for Much Music when I did the Wedge, and he was playing the Rock Pile. Was it called the Rock Pile?
Of course. Yeah.
No, it wasn't the Rock Pile. What was the sketchy kind of like prison themed venue?
Oh, you're talking about the one that was
the generator. Vatican?
No, the one that was out. They had two locations. They had one out west and they had one out east. One is
Rock Pile.
Is it the Rock Pile?
There was the guy from the Big Bop.
Yeah.
I can't remember his name. He opened Rock Pile at Kipling, and there might have been a second location, but
that's it. It is the Rock Pile. There was a Rock Pile East that was out in Scarborough, and it was like in a strip mall that had a strip club. And it was this, you know, very, you know, it made the one out west look like the Horseshoe by comparison. And people listening are not going to have any idea about that comparison. They aren't from Toronto, but it makes it look like the fancy club as opposed to not fancy club. But I went out there and we interviewed Cool Keith. He was playing there. And then after the interview was awesome. He was super cool. And then after the interview, him and his manager cornered me and they're like, where do you go to buy videos in this town? Like porn. And I'm like, oh, like just like a store? And they're like, no. Like the part of town that has like lots of stores that would have it. And I'm like, well, you probably want to go. Like you're in Scarborough, so there is going to be some stuff out here. But I'm like, you probably want to go to like, I guess Young and Dundas area. They're like Young and Dundas. Okay. Yep. Okay. They're like, okay, they're like, right. And then they split. And then my friend stayed for the show. I had to go home, you know, of course, to the family. And my friend stayed to the show and said, Cool Keith was like an hour and a half late because he did a porn run
before the show. Yeah, I've been to a few Cool Keith shows where especially one in Montreal during Pop Montreal with DJ Vadim, I believe, opening. And he was super late. But on top of that, the best thing about Cool Keith's high level of frustratingness is that he has a thing he does in his show where he does like a medley of like all the songs of his that, you know, you like from like,
you're really excited to see.
but he just does the choruses. And if anyone knows Cool Keith choruses, they're just the title of the song repeated like six times, you know, and he'll do that medley sometimes for like 30 to 40 minutes. And but I had an interview with Cool Keith too. It's a great interview. He's really something else. And this album, The Four Horsemen, is just means so much to me because it's just like an example. I can't remember if it was us, we were talking about like lyrics and stuff and specificity, but I mean the whole album is about like I think a baseball player or a baseball team, like the San Francisco team from like the 60s. Three brothers with checks, San Francisco, Harvey. That's the name of the first song. Yeah.
I was a big Cool Keith fan. I think my favorite, I think I like the Dr. Doom record the most.
Oh, Dr. Doom is hilarious.
I was a big fan of that one. And Sex Styles, of course.
That's my favorite.
I mean, Black Elvis is really underrated.
Matthew, that's great too.
Really good stuff. Spankmaster is amazing.
Yeah.
Spankmaster, again, with like his great song choices, has a song called NBA where he's just generally insulting NBA players.
Well, he hooked up with Jackie Jasper, is actually HDV. Am I wrong?
Yeah, he did lots of work with HDV for sure. Yeah.
And HDV was a pimp of the microphone. He was a Toronto rapper.
Yeah. Sex, Drugs, and Violence, was that his album?
Yeah, no, that was BDP, wasn't it?
No, that was Sex and Violence.
No.
Oh, yes, God. That album was called Sex and Violence, and I believe, I'm finding HDV's discography right now as we talk.
Well, I'm kind of obsessed with HDV. I can't get any of his stuff anywhere, so anytime I can...
Oh, I have an HDV CD you can have.
Are you serious?
I
think I have
two. I bought one in Scarborough.
How are we going to do this during the pandemic? I will drive over to your place.
Yeah, I'll figure it out. I'll go over.
Who knew this podcast would get me a HDV CD?
Well, I hope Danko. I didn't sell it or anything. But Danko, I think I still have it.
I fucking knew, man. This podcast, that's what we do here. We're like the Rosetta, like it's just like Needful Things in the Stephen King book, you know? You just come into this podcast, next thing you know, you're walking out with like the CD you've been looking for years.
But yes, it is called Sex, HDV. Drugs, and Violence. And BDP is Sex and Violence.
Sex and Violence, okay.
So just to let your listeners know. And the fact is, if you are a hardcore punk fan, you are probably also a fan of certain eras of hip hop, including the era that HDV was part of. Thank you very much. This has been a message from your hip hop scholar,
Nardwar Flanagan.
I get a lot of Nardwar comparisons.
Well, you went into the Nardwar voice there, I thought.
I didn't even mean to. Thank you very much.
Are you dividing this up into the different times we talk? And putting it all together.
Yeah, it's going to be divided into sections.
Oh, because I was because
this is the backbone interview.
This is we left off the last one while we were talking about beefs.
Yeah,
and you know, I started to run my mouth as I do often, and then I later kind of regret it. So I messaged you after, and I said, hey, could you take out that band that I mentioned, one of the bands that I mentioned, because I thought I threw them under the bus unfairly because they didn't really ever do anything to me. And here I am 20 years later, reigniting or igniting a beef that never was, trying to be a tough, cool guy. And listen, I had no problems. No one knows who I'm talking about except for you two guys.
Yeah, we're the only one.
Yeah, but it really got me thinking after I messaged you, like, I just reevaluated, you know, my attitude.
Dude, career suicide are cool. They probably wouldn't have cared anyway, but you know, it's cool that, you know, I'm glad you tried to bury the hatchet with them.
Yeah. Yeah. Hanoi Rocks are some of the best guys.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah. Like
you guys are are lying.
You're like, you're making up. Bands. Obviously, we're mentally making up. Yeah.
No, I love both those bands. No, it was a band that isn't around anymore. Canadian band, and you know, I when we started our band, I had a tendency, much like Nick and much like you, Damien, we've gotten into beefs with bands and stuff. The three of us.
Oh yes.
Have
our own beefs
yeah. with bands, and you know, I've reached the point where I don't. I will have a beef with a band if they start stuff with me, but I don't want to be an instigator. And I thought what I mentioned on your podcast last time was uncalled for thing to me. It was just a member of the band. She answered me in a way that I thought was, you know, kind of, you know, reeked of attitude for no reason.
Danko?
I don't know. I'm still here.
I'm still here.
That's oh, weird. I'm here.
Oh, you're here. Okay.
Can you guys hear me?
You dropped. Yeah, you dropped out.
We lost
there a
little. We lost you at reeked of attitude.
Oh,
so what we're doing, we lost you at you now revisiting what made you mad.
Yeah, so, no, this is like this is part of the process in my internal dialogue here. But I just want to say. No, I'm sorry. I'm going too deep into nothing.
You're going back into
it. I just reevaluated because we had to talk about beefs and I was like coming off like I'm a tough guy going, yeah, I had tons of beefs. That's not something to be proud of, you know, like,
no.
I think I should really like, you know, get off my high horse sometimes and just be chill about it. Cause I did mention there's people in my life, my personal life who kind of try to check me. And they're not wrong. Sometimes I get too offended too easily. That's my problem.
I mean, I'm not going to disagree with you there.
Yeah, no, and I feel the same. I feel the same.
You've been on the receiving end.
On the receiving end. But also, I feel like I've just been involved with a lot of people who have offended you, you know, rather than that, like, I just, and I'm not denying that that's a thing, like worth being, you know, mentioning, you know, but it's just, at some point when you have this list of grievances, it just piles up so high, you know, and it's like, what are you going to do with that?
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of like an Artie Lang thing where he kind of didn't want to get off whatever was ailing him because he thought that was the source of his creativity. And sometimes I feel the anger is what really pushes me forward.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's performance or whether it's, you know, just doing stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. That's an interesting thing. Like we've probably all had that to some extent, right? Just being in the types of music that we've played,
mm-hmm.
you know? And
yeah, it's a fairly aggressive music, so the anger should be there to match it. And I think trying to find beefs sometimes, like the band that I mentioned, where it doesn't exist, was sometimes it's too cheap, you know.
Well, it also becomes like, you know, it's part of the show, you know, like you're obsessed with these great beefs in music history. Like people make a big deal out of these rivalries that are imaginary or real in some cases, but at the same time, like it's romanticized so much that when you first get into music, you almost like, you know, especially when you first kind of get into the stage where you have a band that has enough of a platform, you're like, oh, let's have a beef. Like, let's who's out there offending me right now. And
yeah.
Yeah.
As you get older and I think you get a little bit wiser and maybe it's not like this anymore. Like maybe people have moved past this, but you just kind of go, oh, that was ridiculous. Like, I really.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I can't think of the last time I started beef. And then in comedy, you know, it's just, it's not even that different than what you guys, what musicians have, where it's like eventually, you know, someone you think is the worst, like, unless they're really outside of your circle, it's like they're still around. You know, you might see them somewhere. And like, what good is all of this? Now it's awkward and they might do something nice for you. And then what? You're going to like have to think about how long you were pissed at what they were doing, you know? And then, well, but I think
Nick, I think you're
gentlemen,
you're
can you
about...
continue for a second? I just go to the washroom. I'll be back in 1 minute.
Okay.
Just go. Keep going.
But I think, Nick, what you're talking about are things, are beefs that are actual beefs. And what I was addressing with Damien was a non-existent beef.
Well, no, I mean, I'm talking about if you see somebody live, like, I mean, not to throw each of us under the bus in the comedy thing, but it's like when we would go to comedy shows, when we were first starting, when I was first starting to do comedy and you'd come out with me, I think that we were, in order to feel confident about what we were doing, we had to hold the whole thing in disdain, you know?
Yes. No, I totally understand what you mean.
Yeah.
That is definitely...
But we are talking about two different things. I agree with you. Like you're talking about like literally just like creating something out of nothing for just.
Well, it's not nothing. Well. I still hold resentment to what that person said.
Yeah.
You know, I still, but not enough to turn it into a beef. That's just you. And that's just me and my problems or, you know, and I shouldn't, you know, say it in a public forum and turn it into something that is a beef, you know, that's just, we all have opinions of people where we have no public beef, but we still kind of privately just go, oh, what a douchebag or what an asshole, but we'll never say it publicly because we don't want to turn it into a thing. And I felt when we last spoke, I was turning a private opinion into a public beef.
Well, yeah, this must be something that happens on like podcasts a lot because it's just not the same as an interview. And a lot of time it's like us three, the three of us talking are just like, we know each other well enough that we'll just say whatever. But then
I've had gnarly shit like that happen. Like where I've had multiple people come on here and say something about someone, you know, and it's, you know, and I like, and I think nothing of it. And then all of a sudden the person writes me like, yo, what the fuck? And I'm like, oh shit. Yeah, you're right. I didn't think about that. You're right. I can see that now. And so
I really,
you know, but it's also like, there's some people that have truth that they want to tell too, you know, and also who,
sure.
You know, so it's like a, obviously
it's delicate.
It's delicate. Yeah. I've had some people like say some stuff where, you know, they've gotten themselves in situations. I've had people say something about stuff about people that wasn't necessarily positive, but then it led to them talking and they became friends out of it. So, you know,
yeah. Right.
It works weirdly.
Well, in that spirit, I will say that, you know, we mentioned Robin Black last time. Look, there's no beef. I mean, JC in our band, he's like privately told me to like cool the fuck down. And so in that spirit, I want to take back everything I said. It all happened and the anger was there, but the anger shouldn't be there like in 2020.
Yeah. And I should let that be known as well, is that, you know, in the brief period of time that I was flirting with the idea of holding myself accountable and contacting all people I felt I'd done wrong, I was like, oh, I might have to hit up Robin Black and say I'm sorry about that. Then I didn't, but it's like, you know, in the end, what it is, I think, is for me, and I can really relate it to being younger than I am now, which is like, especially with the anger thing, is like, you kind of want that fuel, like you don't know where it's going to come from necessarily. So
yeah, that's what I was.
Yeah. And it's that record snob thing too, where you're like, well, I like this music, but I don't like that music, you know?
Well, it's all born out of insecurity. Right. And I think when you start getting on stage, you kind of have to, like, so much of it is about ego and vibrato, you know, bravado, and just kind of like trying to put yourself out there as being something so you can get on stage and act a fool and entertain people like that, which is such an unnatural thing to do. But it lends itself to this sort of like ego and insecurity kind of constantly being at play, you know?
Well, and that's exaggerated male bullshit as well, like not what you're saying, but like I think that that's a big part of fronting a band, and I think that in some ways that's like what we're all doing, you know, especially off top. Like it's like you see these models that are like ridiculous and you kind of subvert them because it's funny to be a dick to actually just being like a dick, you know? And like, you know, or like I'm confronting this guy because I think they're lame, you know? And it's like, I know that's ridiculous, and but I love ridiculous. And it's like, well, other people just think you're being like unnecessarily mean.
Well, my whole thing with beefs is I never confronted anybody. My beefs would start when they would poke at me.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah,
so you doing what Robin would be.
I just apologize and then literally snickered when you were like, "You doing?" I mean, the thing where we dressed up like them for Halloween when we played a show with them.
Yeah, I still hold that night or that show as like one of the biggest balls I've ever seen on stage to do that. Like that's the, and so that was my go-to the last time we spoke.
I mean, it's just lack of
If I was Robin and I was me being Robin and my attitude, I would hold a grudge against you for life.
Yeah, I think Robin is cool. You know, I think that's the ultimate thing at the end of the day is that, you know, and I think that's what you realize as you get older is that, fuck, we all, like the fact that, you know, here's a person that probably fucking liked the New York Dolls and the Stooges. And
right.
We're in a world where there are so few people that like that stuff. Like, I think that's the thing. As mm-hmm. I get older, I look at people yeah. that at one point I would have been like, well, they're not into my type of, my brand of counterculture. Yeah, yeah. And now I'm like, fuck, they were in a counterculture. How cool was that?
No, it's absolutely yeah, yeah, true. Yeah. I mean, it's like, I weirdly relate it to, I think.
Reading, it's true. That's such a good point.
Yeah. Reading Rick James's autobiography and like understanding that, like he describes his music and like the amount of influences for it. Not that I thought Rick James was like, he was like pretty brilliant. Like before I read this, but an understanding that it was this combination of like orchestral funk and jazz and all this and disco and all this shit. I was like, wow, like everybody's like in a lot of successful bands have like a pretty interesting recipe that just because I don't agree with doesn't mean it's not like there, it doesn't contain elements of things you like. And that's something I learned oddly enough from the music of Little Peep. You know, like yeah. That guy Lil Peep and is like some of his stuff I is like too much for me. But the fact that he has this like Linkin Park influence and other stuff from this like emo era that I wanted nothing to do with. Not that I'm equating Linkin Park to emo, but I enjoy a lot of his songs because it's this combination of like hip hop, like of a certain type and this. It's like, oh, like when you go 10 years later and you see the impact it has on like other music and it's kind of a good impact, it's like, oh, like what am I doing wrong? And just to say this about Robin Black is like, honestly, all I ever heard from like, I like, yeah, we had like a graffiti war with each other or something, but in the jam building, but like all I ever heard was he'd go up to people and be like, why don't they like us? And yeah. then, and like, there was no, like he took the Joe Biden route essentially just kind of let us, you know, carve out a niche for people who were pissed at.
I can't remember if I mentioned the story. I think I did the last time we spoke about, you know, the backstory to our beef that nobody ever saw or heard about. And that just sits with me. You know, I have to learn to just let it go. And if I see Robin, this is what JC told me, because I actually saw Robin somewhere a couple of years back, maybe three years ago somewhere. And I told JC, and JC said, why didn't you go up to him and say hi?
Right.
I'm like, are you kidding me? You know what that guy did in 1999 to us? So like, I got to let go. So when I mentioned, like last time we spoke, it sent me on. And then
I don't think you told us the story. Am I forgetting? Is it the weed and the concussions?
No, it was an interview or something.
No. Yeah. There's several incidents that led up to the beef, but that no one got to see. But
yeah.
There was one time my girlfriend at the time wanted to introduce me to Robin because she was friends with both of us. And she, oh, you guys would get along. So we went out for drinks I believe it was upstairs at the Elmo. I cannot really remember the place, but it was the three of us and then a friend of his who was in another band that I didn't know.
Oh, yeah. From, you did tell from, this. Yeah.
Yeah. From they were from the same town and they just ended up talking and name dropping and not really talking to me. And so I quietly sat there and, you know, my resentment just grew. But by the end of it, you know, I was done. And that's just how I'm built.
Hang on. I'm going to get some water myself.
I don't like to exclude people like that. Like yeah, I basically yeah. get beefs when I feel I would never treat that person the way they're treating me. And that's I go, should this beef be activated? And then that is what I use. And I say, yes, I would never treat that person that way. They treated me this way. Beef activated.
It's one, I'm not defending, you know, or excusing, you know, that exclusion in that conversation. But at the same time, one thing I will say is that just from the outside looking in at you at that time, you had been portrayed as such like a rock and roll superhero that I imagine, like, once again, it's the ego thing that he was probably intimidated. You know I was super fucking intimidated by you back then. Like, you were like, you know, like 30 feet tall, you know, like I remember the Bristol Bruce article that like talking about you guys. And it was just like so much energy around the band and mystique that it's intimidating.
But here's the thing. I've heard that said before, but here's the thing is like, I was probably wearing a Club Monaco sweater and like Gap khaki pants, like just very unassuming.
Yeah.
Like,
and a baseball hat.
Yeah. And I don't walk into a room like, you know, like if you see Lemmy or Michael Monroe walk into a room, they walk into a room.
Well,
I always try to hide, you know, like
don't you have two earrings on one earring on each ear and they were big?
Yeah, that
they kind of had this like buccaneer thing, you know, like
once again to bring it back to like the fan perspective of the time. I remember when you walked in backstage at the Lions Club to sing with Countdown to Oblivion. And it was like, oh shit, like a rock star walk, not because you know, you had that attitude, but just because that's like the aura that had been given to you.
But didn't you sing with
Toronto at the time?
Did you
sing? I had no idea of that. I had nothing.
That was the coolest thing ever. Like when you came out and you did the Youth of the Day song, I think you did like a Black Flag song, maybe. A
Negative Approach.
Song.
But did you do that with us too? Why do I have a memory of that? Is it just like
you were at that show. With you guys. Oh, I don't know. Maybe you also did something else with them, but I don't remember that at a hardcore show.
Well, didn't I sing Wash Dish or something?
Yes, but we
something like that.
We don't mention any Teen Chord Combo song titles. We just tell people that we're a good band and we wait until an era where people are really, really, really like into sarcasm and satire and made by teenagers. And so basically it's when like, what's that band like Angry Samoans kind of resurgence? No,
the Meat Men, when the Meat Men popular comeback starts.
But I was gonna say, like, you know, I didn't have that with Danko as much. Like, when did we meet, do you think? Like, what's our meet cute?
Danko. I can't place it. I can't place it. I don't know.
I mean, I think it was just that I was going to shows because of my buddy Mike Gribben and Deb and them. And so I would be at shows. Horse Shack, like your old band, was often opening, and maybe even Violent Brothers, all the way from the Opera House to, did you guys open for Jesus Lizard at the Horseshoe?
The Horse Shack band did. We opened up for the Jesus Lizard. Yeah.
Yeah. So I saw you with Jesus Lizard. I saw you maybe with Mule or Laughing. And I knew JC from Cat Rocket because I was seeing that band back then. So
he was in Cat Rocket.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I got a Cat Rocket 7-inch. I think I have two different versions of it.
Well, he's playing on it, bro.
Whoa!
He's
probably playing on it.
That's fucking wild.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's probably on most of the recordings where they were getting the most attention.
They were getting attention. You guys are blowing my mind. This is like a whole other side of Toronto.
I mean, Cat Rocket had a period of time where they were almost in that, like, I don't want to say belly, but like something along those lines, like like in the like heavenly or something. I saw a bunch of good Cat Rocket shows. I was into Cat Rocket when they were out, and you know, but also, you know, Danko Jones were very supportive of Teen Chord Combo from the word go. And also the other reason I think that I had a different relationship with you was just because I knew a lot of CHRY DJs. I knew our mutual friend Ken Sum, I think, even at that point, from like video stores, and you know, so I think it was just like a little less intimidating. And I was never, as far as I recall, like in the like Danko Jones, like being mean to about Danko Jones club, except everyone, I knew lots of people who were, and I was in bands that were, but you know.
Yeah, that publicly dissed us, yeah. But that's okay. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, I got mad at you. Yeah, our whole history together is me getting mad at you.
For people I know.
For yeah, but you poking at me, and then I get mad, and then, you know, and it goes all, it's like a merry-go-round.
Yes, it is. Great Laughing Hyenas album.
But Damien,
subpar replacements album.
Our starting point was so easy to remember because it was so memorable, such a memorable starting point.
Well, as I tell, but that's your starting point, like the festival in Europe, right?
Yeah.
We had met twice before at record stores. But I was just
a
kid at the record store type vibe. And then, but I'd seen you, like I'd been to your shows, and I knew you came out of punk rock because I know you'd played Nomi's birthday party, and that's the 7-inch release party, right?
Oh yeah, you were there.
No, I wasn't at the 7-inch release party. I was at a show, like another basement show or something. Maybe it was at that party.
I don't know. I was in and out of that scene. You know, I was.
You guys took off, and you guys were like the band, you know, like, and there's like you know, so it was then there was like a mystique, like seeing you guys play live and all this kind of stuff. So it was you know, like it was definitely, you know, a thing that I, you know, was intimidated by as like a kid, 100%. You know, but I didn't react negatively to it. I kind of was like, oh, this guy's cool, you know.
Right, like a lot of people did. And I guess when going back to Robin, I guess I just read it wrong, and he read me wrong, and I read him wrong. And here we are, you know, talking about it. And he probably doesn't even care or think about me. And I don't wake up every day thinking about Robin, but it's just, you know, when I did see him like 3-4 years ago, across the room or whatever, you know, it brought back memories, and I'm pretty sure I can bet $100 he would be cool with me.
Oh yeah.
While I had to get the fucking thing out of my ass to like fucking be cool with him. So yeah. I'm the guy who needs to, you know, figure it out.
But that's the thing. He's like through it, right? Like, cause he kind of like stepped away from music. Like last time I saw him, we talked, and he's like, oh yeah. Like, I'm like, oh, you ever want to do a band again and something? He's like, nah, not really. Like, he's like on the other side of stuff. Right. Like,
I get my kicks literally kicking.
No, now he does. He's a huge social media guy with his fight breakdowns and
yeah. Stuff well, that's like what that. I say. I mean, like, it's just like the MMA stuff.
Yeah. Know? No, he definitely, you know, as we talked about before, like at any time he could have like spin kicked all our heads off, you know, like his hands are probably registered weapons.
For more Beef Talk and other hilarious chatter involving Danko Jones and Nick Flanagan, head over to part 3 and also some other amazing guests. See you over there.